Now, it is annoying for a guest to have to sit through an extended or even an abbreviated version of their CV, but in the case of Shashi Tharoor, I absolutely insist on reminding you that he's a member of the Indian National Congress. He was their special spokesman for Yonks. He was a career official at the UN, and he was an Undersecretary General there, and in fact finished second in the 2006 selection for the Secretary General job to Ban Ki-moon. Acclaimed writer, 16 or more at last count, best-selling works of fiction, non-fiction, and they're all centred on India and its history, culture, film, politics, society, foreign policy, etc. He's a columnist. He's been a columnist for all sorts of publications from the New York Times to the Times of India, with the Washington Post, Time, Newsweek, and other publications thrown in between. And I think he's been a little bit annoyed by the sentimental and romanticised coverage of the British Raj with which we are being inundated, up to and including that book of Niall Ferguson's Empire, How Britain Made the Modern World. And he's about to cut to shreds any romantic notions of the Raj. Now, welcome back to the program, Shashi. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Philip. Good to be with you.
Now, the last time we spoke, you just had an interesting response to the video of a short speech you made at Oxford, which went viral, particularly in India. 70 years since independence, is the memory of life under British starting to fade? Do young people in India understand what happened under the British? Your answer, please.
By and large, no, Philip. And I think, in fact, that was the revelation to me when I delivered my speech at the Oxford Union on the iniquities of British colonialism. I had absolutely no expectation that it would go as viral as it did. I think in the first 24 hours after the Oxford Union put it up on their website, it had attracted 3 million downloads, and it's continued since. And I think part of the reason is precisely because Indians, whether living in India or abroad, had either never learned or had allowed themselves to forget. And the result, therefore, was that there was this shock of recognition that this is where we've come from, and we need to know it to appreciate where we are today and where we ought to be going. So there was a tremendous, tremendous feedback, and that prompted my publisher to demand a book out of me on the same theme, which is what I'm here to promote at the Melbourne Writers' Festival and at the Sydney Opera House, Inglourious Empire.
Is India, or does India have the largest of the diasporas?
Oh, yes. I think we have something like 25 million people of Indian extraction around the world, some of whom have taken on other countries' passports and many who haven't. So it's quite a large diaspora.
Okay, let's look at some of the myths swirling around the topic that you deal with in Empire. One of them seems to have manifested itself in the vote in Brexit, a sort of a yearning for an earlier time when Britain was more powerful.
Well, there certainly were some people in London who started speaking of the idea of resurrecting Empire 2.0, as they put it, to which my reaction was that that would go over like a lead balloon in the former colonies. Given that we think Empire 1.0 was such a terrible idea, why on earth would you float 2.0? But, you know, I think in looking for a post-Brexit set of connections, the former empire struck many people in Britain as a logical way to go. I say, well, that's all very well, but the terms of trade are not the ones that were available to you at the point of a gun for 200 years. It's going to be different now. And if there's give and take, yes, one can resurrect good relations, but not on the basis of the old imperial rules.
As you can hear, ladies and gentlemen, we have with us a myth buster. So let's look at some of the myths that are ripe for busting. Now, there is a perception that when the East India Company came to India, that India was an economic backwater. But that's far from the truth.
Far from the truth. It was, in fact, in 1700, the richest country on earth with 27% of global GDP. And as late as 1800, when Britain was already ruling good chunks of it, it had 23% of global GDP. It was a leading manufacturer and exporter of sophisticated textiles for 2,000 years. Going back to the Roman Empire, Pliny the Elder records debates in the Roman Senate, complaints of how all of Rome's gold was being sunk into India to purchase Indian muslins, linens, and fine cottons. We have accounts in British literature of shopkeepers in England in the 16th, 17th, and even early 18th centuries trying to pass off shoddily European-made goods as made in India because made in India had a higher cachet and fetched a bigger price. So that was the country that Britain marched into, not some unsophisticated backwater, but a highly sophisticated civilization with its own banking system, its own free trade, its own ports, its own record of shipbuilding, steel making, and of course, textile manufacturing. And the British systematically destroyed all of this.
Well, 23% of the world's economy. It's 3% by the time the British left. And
that's
let's
right.
see how that happened. Let's have a look at some of those industries. You've mentioned textiles. Huge in India in the 1600s, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, the British, well, later than that too, right up to the late 1700s, it was a major export. But the British initially came to trade. The East Indian Company, East India Company was a trading company, but they rapidly realized it was more profitable to trade at the point of a gun, and they proceeded to do that. And once they had actually sequestered the ports, they restricted the trade, essentially imposing a monopoly. And when they controlled territory, they started imposing punitive tariffs on Indian exports while lifting tariffs on the imports into India of British cloth. Systematically destroyed the industry. They also physically destroyed it, smashing looms. In at least one notorious documented incident, they cut off the thumbs of weavers so they couldn't weave again. Really quite a lot.
I'm sorry. Say that again. They what?
They cut off the thumbs of a whole bunch of weavers in Murshidabad in Bengal so that they couldn't weave again after their looms had been smashed. The fear was the looms would be rebuilt and they'd start weaving again, and that would be competition the East India Company couldn't handle. So they cut off their thumbs. This is according to a contemporary Dutch observer who published a book in 1772 documenting this atrocity.
Now, you talked about tariffs. Heavy tariffs on exports, they were as high as 80%.
That's right. Well, you know, the amusing thing is that people like Ferguson, whom you've mentioned already, speak of Britain having promoted free trade. Well, they promoted their free trade by smashing the free trade that already existed that Indians were profiting from.
So cotton sold to the East India Company, Indians had to buy back the textiles made in England.
That's right. And of course, it got worse with the Industrial Revolution because then the Brits could manufacture far vaster quantities than traditional Indian handlooms could have. Now, in the older days, when the Indian textile manufacturers were exporting their goods and were doing very well, they could have afforded to buy the new machines themselves from Europe. But not anymore when they'd been reduced into impoverishment by the Brits, and the Brits could thrust their products down the throats of the Indians.
Let's look at another area. Let's look at shipbuilding. That was also devastated by the Brits.
Yes, the irony was that Indian ships were actually better than British ships. Their craftsmanship was superb, as British observers at the time pointed out, both in terms of woodwork as well as brass fixtures and fittings and so on that went on it. And initially, the British actually started making ships in India because, for example, not only the quality of the craftsmanship, but the quality of the wood was so much better. Indian teak and mahogany tended to last 25, 26 years, whereas European ships made of fir and pine rarely lasted more than 6 or 7 years in those days. So British companies thought it would make a lot of sense to have their ships made in India. Well, the British in Parliament, of course, realized this was not such a good thing because it suddenly was throwing a lot of shipwrights and fitters and cartwrights and so on out of work in the London dockyards. So the Parliament passed an act that forbade ships from India or made in India to ply the lucrative international waters to England. And that killed that bit of the shipbuilding industry as well.
Okay, let's look at steel. I loved the story of the Tata family who struggled to get their mill set up in the 1800s.
Well,
that,
you know,
that ended in a rather satisfactory way.
Well, I'll come to that, but if I may just mention that earlier, India had invented its own steel that was so highly respected, the Arabs came and borrowed the Indian metallurgical technology to make their famous Damascus steel. And when European soldiers, the British in other words, killed Indians in those early battles, they would dismount and steal the Indian soldiers' swords because the soldiers' swords were made of so much better quality steel than anything available in Europe. The British destroyed that industry and then, of course, with various restrictions, made it impossible for Indians to manufacture. And then Jamshedji Tata tried to set up a modern steel mill in the late 19th century. They kept him dangling for decades, denying him permissions and licenses and imposing all sorts of restrictions on him. And finally, in fact, he set up a factory but didn't live to see the first ingots of steel coming out of it. His son did. The ironic footnote to which you allude is that 100 years later, or less than 100 years later, in the late 1990s, the descendants of the same Jamshedji Tata bought the remnants of British steel by acquiring Corus. Now, when Tata was trying to set up a steel plant, a senior British imperial official had sneered that he would personally eat every ounce of steel that an Indian was capable of producing. I just wish he'd lived long enough to see the British steel being swallowed up, because it might have given him a bad case of indigestion.
You're listening to a week of the very best of Late Night Live from this year on ABCRN and via your ABC Listen app. And my guest, Shashi Tharoor, author of Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India, published by Scribe. Let's look at what the British did do. What did the Romans ever do for you? Britain did build miles and miles and miles of railway tracks, which were an enormous benefit to the country.
Well, they didn't build them for us, Philip. And the fact is that the British, from the very beginning, had no illusions about why they needed the railways in India. First of all, to extract resources from the interior, bring it to the ports to ship to England, materials like cotton, of course, but also minerals, iron, coal, all of that. Secondly, the British wanted to send their soldiers into the hinterland in order to quell any potential unrest. And the trains were a far more efficient way of doing that than going on horseback. They also made an awful lot of money on the building of the railways. It was a gigantic colonial scam. They actually poured money into the building of the railways because they were guaranteed double the rate of return of the highest returning in British government security out of money paid by the Indian taxpayer. So it was described at the time as private profit at public risk, except the private profit was all British and the public risk was all Indian, the Indian taxpayer. They spent so much money, in fact, that a single mile of Indian railway cost nine times what the same mile cost in the US or Australia, for that matter, around the same time. So it really was quite deplorable. And they ran the railways as a racist enterprise, right down to the costs. I mean, the British companies paid the lowest freight rates in the world. The Indian passengers who eventually climbed on paid the highest passenger rates in the world.
It's interesting that India was more than capable of building its own locomotives, but a law was passed making it impossible to manufacture them in India. In a century, between 54 and 1947, India imported 14,000 locomotives.
Mm-hmm. Mainly from England, some from Germany and other European places, but mainly from England. In fact, when the railways were initially built, everything came from England. Every nut, bolt and screw, every rail, every engine, every rick, every compartment, everything came from England. So a lot of money was made by the English on the building of the Indian railways. And it was only after independence that India was able to transform the Indian railways into something designed to benefit the Indian traveller, particularly the poor Indian traveller, with what are still today amongst the cheapest rail fares in the world, the opposite of what they were under the British Raj.
Did any British at the time acknowledge or even protest what was happening, the way they were draining your country of its wealth?
Yes, I mean, in all fairness, one should point out that right throughout the colonial enterprise, there were dissenting voices in Britain. In fact, in the initial decades, the church, the missionaries, were actually quite negative about the enterprise. That changed a bit by the mid-19th century onwards. But initially, some of the most savage condemnations of the East India Company and the savagery of British colonialism was delivered by passionate preachers like William Howell, the anti-slavery campaigner, and others. A lot of my quotes in the book are actually from British sources. There were testimonies in the House of Commons, for example, including by former administrators in India, of a lot of the iniquities that the British perpetrated. So it really was something that was acknowledged at the time. This is not 2020 hindsight. It's just that those voices were drowned out by the love of lucre that kept the filthy enterprise going.
Another myth you might like to bust, and that is the notion that the very nation of India was, essentially a British creation.
Well, that's among the most preposterous things imaginable, because the very idea of India goes back to the Rig Veda in roughly 1500 BC, about 3,500 years ago, which actually mentions the idea of Bharat Varsh as the land between the Himalayas and the oceans. And that idea is something which civilizationally has been embedded in the Indian consciousness for those 3,500 years. And various monarchs, well before the British, had tried to unite the territory. The Mauryas under Chandragupta and Ashoka in the 3rd century BC did that. And then, of course, the Mughals under Akbar and Aurangzeb also controlled about 95% of the subcontinent, which, of course, is defined as including what's today Afghanistan as well as Pakistan. So this is something, the territorial aspiration to unite all of India and the civilizational existence of this go back way, way before the British. Now, there's no question that the British rule created, if you like, the modern state, the Indian state in its present form. But to suggest that nobody else, given the advantages of modern communications and modern weaponry and modern technology, wouldn't have done it is absurd, because every Indian ruler was trying to do it and too nearly succeeded, and others would have if they weren't the Brits.
The Mughals had controlled, 90% of the subcontinent before the Brits arrived, and mm-hmm. famously the Brits used that system of divide and rule, you know, pitting one prince against another.
It wasn't just a prince against another, which many of us wouldn't have minded. It was defining Indians by immutable identities like religion and pitching one religion against another. And this was a very deliberate policy. There was a big revolt, which the British like to label the Sepoy Mutiny. It was much more than a mutiny. It was a full-fledged revolt in 1857 against the British. And when the British saw Hindu and Muslim soldiers fighting side by side and under each other's command and under the banner of the enfeebled Mughal monarch against the hated foreign oppressor, they said, this should never be allowed to happen again. And Lord Elphinstone wrote a celebrated memo saying, Divide et impera is the old Roman maxim and it shall be ours. Divide et impera, Latin for divide and rule, was then the policy they followed. They very deliberately and consciously incited a sense of Muslim separateness, and indeed separateness of each community, in order to prevent the emergence of an Indian national consciousness and an Indian united Indian freedom movement.
And of course,
for a long time they didn't succeed, but in the end they pulled it off.
And of course, the British had to be dragged, kicking and screaming, to the resolution of the problem by giving India its nationhood. They didn't go easily or willingly.
Well, by the end they did, Philip, because they were exhausted by the Second World War. They'd been bombed and battered. They had incurred vast quantities of debts, including debts to the Indian Exchequer. They were exhausted. They really were tired. And, you know, the defeat of Churchill in 45, in the elections of 45, sort of set the seal on that, because Attlee, in any case, like other Labour leaders, was quite sympathetic to the notion of Indian independence all along.
And, of course, Churchill was deplorably racist in regard to India.
Oh, he was an awfully racist individual, said the most racist things and behaved in the most obnoxiously racist manner. The thing that I most hold against him was his management, if that's the word, of the Great Bengal Famine, in which decisions he took directly led to the loss of 4.3 million human lives, which is why the notion in many Western countries of Churchill as some sort of apostle of freedom sticks in the craw, because he certainly was responsible. His hands are as bloodstained as those of the worst genocidal leaders of the 20th century.
Let's dwell on that a little, because I suspect that most of our listeners are unfamiliar with that catastrophe.
Well, Churchill, first of all, there was a long history of British policy on famines, whether in Ireland or in India, which was a compound of a number of so-called British principles. Number one, you know, don't intervene with the workings of the market. If market prices go beyond the means of those who need to buy food, we'll let them starve. Then the Malthusian principle, that if the land can't sustain the population that's trying to live off it, people must die. That's the principle that Malthus articulated. The notion that one must not provide charity or relief because it only encourages idleness. And finally, of course, fiscal prudence. One must not spend money one hasn't budgeted for. And this combination of decisions led to the totally unnecessary loss of 35 million Indian lives in British-run famines. The British historian Mike Davies has called it Holocausts, the late Victorian Holocaust, as he describes them. Now, Churchill, therefore, was an heir to that policy. But nonetheless, by the time he was prime minister, it was the middle of the 20th century, and people were supposed to have more enlightened ideas. But when the war was on and Bengalis were starving after a drought, Churchill decided not only to ship grain from starvation-ridden, famine-ridden Bengal to Europe, but to do so not to directly, immediately aid the war effort, but to bolster the buffer stocks that were being piled up in the event of a future invasion of Greece and Yugoslavia. And he said, I hate Indians. They're a beastly people with a beastly religion. When he heard about the famine that was resulting from these policies, he said, well, it's all their fault anyway for breeding like rabbits. He then proceeded, for example, when ships from Australia were docking in Calcutta port, to not allow them to disgorge their supplies of wheat, but rather to carry on to Europe to continue to add to these buffer stocks. Decisions he personally took and minuted on file, or instructed his odious paymaster general, Lord Cherwell, to do. And when conscience-stricken British officials sent him a note telling him that his policies were costing lives and people were dropping dead on the streets in Bengal, he just wrote on the margin of the file, very peevishly, "Why hasn't Gandhi died yet?" And this is the man that we're supposed to look up to as some sort of British hero. It was a deeply unpleasant piece of work who clearly didn't have a conscience, or he would not surely be lying still in his grave today. He would be rolling over at the thought of what he'd done.
What have the Romans ever done for us? Deal now with the notion or the argument that Britain brought democracy to India.
It had to be prized from their reluctant grasp, Philip. I mean, there was, if you like, an educated, Anglophile, loyally elite that could have been entrusted with some form of democratic self-representative government, as it happened in the so-called White Commonwealth by the late 19th century, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa. But India was denied it. First of all, I suppose, because Britain didn't see Indians as being in the same league, and secondly, because they didn't want anything to prevent their continued exploitation and depredations in India. But the result that they denied it to India, the history of India between the founding of the Indian National Congress in 1885 and the passage of the Government of India Act 1935, which is, as you know, 50 years later, is littered with broken promises of self-government made and then broken, including the disgraceful performance during the First World War and just after, when India, including Mahatma Gandhi, supported the Allied effort in the First World War because of explicit promises of responsible self-government after it. And those promises were not only broken, the British imposed wartime era restrictions on things like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, instead of keeping their word. And this resulted in a lot of protests, which culminated in the savagery of the Amritsar massacre, the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, in which a British general ordered the opening of fire without a single warning on unarmed men, women, and children gathered in a walled garden, and mowed down large numbers of them. The British admitted to 379 people killed in less than an hour. The Indians claim it was more than 1,000. But the odiousness of what happened was followed by the barring of the gates. The relatives couldn't attend to the dead, the dying and the wounded, who were forced to lie there for 24 hours to rot in the hot sun. Indians were made to crawl on their bellies on a street nearby, and if they so much as lifted their heads, they were bashed in by British staves. And after all of this, this man, General Dyer, a collection is raised to reward him by the British, and the equivalent in today's money of £250,000 is presented to him with a bejewelled sword, while that flatulent voice of Victorian imperialism, Rudyard Kipling, hailed him as the man who saved India by massacring large numbers of innocents. This was probably, for those reasons, the single worst atrocity of the Raj, and its centenary is coming up on the 13th of April 2019, which I think would be a very good occasion for a senior Brit, ideally a member of the royal family, because everything was done in the name of the crown, to come and apologise at that venue to the people of India for that atrocity and, by extension, all the wrongs that were done for 200 years. I think it would have a salutarily cleansing effect.
I'm almost reluctant to ask about the British bringing a system of justice and law to India. I know that you find this particularly exasperating.
Yes, because the rule of law was applied with excessive attention to the skin colour of the defendant. I believe that happened in Australia too, but in India, of course, the darker races, as it were, outnumbered the paler ones, and yet no Indians were allowed to try. English people, there were dozens of murders of Indians by Englishmen every year. They were always excused, often with a mild fine or a rap on the knuckles. One of the favourite forms in which the English used to kill Indians was Englishmen kicking their domestic servants to death. And an entire theory was evolved that this was because every Indian was actually malarial and had an enlarged spleen, and he was actually dying of a ruptured spleen rather than of being kicked brutally. Punch magazine even published an entire ode to the stout British boot, which was, of course, the favourite instrument of British discipline over Indians. In 200 years of British rule and hundreds of deaths, there are only three cases recorded in which Englishmen were convicted of murdering Indians, whereas an Indian who so much as raised his hand against an Englishman was liable to be hanged, shot, jailed for life, blown from the mouth of a cannon, or transported to the Andaman Islands to serve out his life in a remote island. I mean, this was the kind of rule of law the British left us with, in addition to an excessively procedure-obsessed system, which has given India such a backlog of cases. There are still cases in India that were filed during the British Raj that haven't been adjudicated yet.
One of the useful things in the new book is that you remind us that the aforementioned diaspora was in fact an official policy. Labour was shipped off to UK colonies like, well, Mauritius, South Africa, Fiji.
Right, and initially the Straits Settlements, Singapore and so on. Not to Australia. I think we had enough others to come here, but certainly Indians helped build Singapore from scratch in the 1850s onwards. They were sent off to Southern Africa, to the Caribbean, to Mauritius, Fiji. And indentured labour was the practice. It really, in theory, wasn't slavery anymore, since slavery had been abolished. That people were essentially supposed to pay off their bondage over a period of years. But in many cases, when their bondage expired, they had no life to return to, and some of them didn't even know how to exercise the theoretical right of return. So practically nobody, not even 5% of indentured labour, ever made it back to India. They settled in the countries where they were exported to, and they became the root of this vast diaspora. There's a modern diaspora as well now of successful professionals going off to places like Australia and America, but they're much smaller in number than the descendants of these original forced indentured labourers.
Did Churchill ever acknowledge how many Indian soldiers died on the battlefields for Britain?
I mean, not in anything more than a perfunctory manner. The British, of course, did value military service, even if they paid the Indian soldiers less than the white ones, if they gave them inferior conditions of service and inferior residence and so on, they did tend to acknowledge Indian soldiers. So that, it's possible Churchill said something along those lines. I haven't come across it. But whether that acknowledgement involved any moral or other kind of debt to India, or certainly any political consequences, there I can assure you Churchill never saw that. But Churchill essentially saw these as sort of loyal soldiers, much the way in which a Southern American would have regarded his black slaves as sort of loyal field hands, not as people with any rights of their own.
Well, he started by remembering the speech you made at Oxford that triggered the controversy. And you, in that you talked about whether or not Britain should pay reparations. Now, you've already said that what you'd really like to see is an apology, and you've identified the date. But isn't there a case for reparations?
Well, Philip, the thing is that there is a moral case, but how on earth do you quantify the enormous damage done? There was an attempt made by an Englishman called William Digby in 1901, who published a 700-page book that I have on my laptop, in which he calculated down to the penny and with perhaps suspicious accuracy the amount of money that Britain had drained out, which in those days was worth already £1 billion. But today, of course, with inflation and everything else, it'd be worth a good deal more. The Indian contribution in the First World War alone is worth over £80 billion in today's money. But on top of that, how do you put a price on the lives lost of those 35 million people I mentioned who died totally unnecessary deaths and British-created famines? I don't really think you can put a monetary value. And that's why, though I did speak in the reparations debate, since that was the topic the Oxford Union chose, my own view, even in that debate, was that a symbolic £1 a year for the next 200 years would be enough. Because for me, it wasn't about money. It's about a moral debt. It's about atonement. And the apology is one part of it. There's another thing the British could do, and that's to compensate for the historical amnesia that they've willfully created in Britain, where you can actually do A-levels in history today without learning a line of colonial history.
Well, as you know, we had a sorry day in Australia where a Prime Minister apologised to the Aboriginal people for some of the crimes we committed against them. Even that was divisive here. Another Prime Minister, for example, refused to attend the ceremony in Parliament House, and many turned their backs at the ceremony. So sorry days, apologies don't necessarily create unity or cohesion. They, in and of themselves, can deepen the divide. But I guess that's another question. Isn't it astonishing how well India has done since independence, given the state the country was left in?
Yes, well, that's certainly something one can speak of with pride. I mean, it's not that India is perfect, far from it. We're full of various flaws, and we Indians are very good at pointing out our own flaws. But when you realise the British left us with a literacy rate below 17%, and we're now up at 79%, or that that only 8.8% of Indian women could read or write, and that's now up to 67%, or that life expectancy of an Indian born in 1947 when the British left was 27, and is today closer to the biblical 70, and so on and so forth. In every indicator, there's been a vast improvement given where we started. In fact, in the first 47 years of the century when the British were ruling, the economic rate of growth averaged 0.01%. And the fact is, for the last 25 years, we've consistently shot above 6%, and for a good decade, over 8%. So clearly a lot of things have been done right, and I'm proud of that. But I don't think it permits us the luxury of forgive and forget. Forgive, yes, because I think rancor, bitterness and so on are absolutely useless emotions, and they corrode the person who feels them far more than the target of the rancor or the bitterness. But I do believe that the problem with forgive and forget is the second word. One must not forget. One must remember. One must remember the past for its own sake. Leave it in the past. Don't let it poison the present, but be conscious of it. I keep telling young people, if you don't know where you've come from, how will you appreciate where you're going?
Shashi, thank you very much. Shashi Tharoor, author of Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India, published by Scribe.